Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step 1, download Rocket Money. Step 2, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step 3, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hey, this is DeRay, and welcome to Potsy of the People. On this episode, we're joined by Tish James, who is running to be the next Attorney General of the state of New York and is the current public advocate in the city of New York. And then we have the news with me, Brittany Clinton Sam, as usual. Today is a big day for me because it is the day that my first book comes out. The book is called On the Other Side of Freedom. You can get it today wherever you buy books, at a bookstore. You can get it online at DeRay.com. And also, tomorrow is the beginning of the tour. I'll be in 16 cities across the country, and this is not a traditional tour. This is really bringing people together in every city for conversations about where we've been and where we need to go. At every step, I'll be joined by a set of special guests in New York City on Wednesday, September 5th. It'll be me, the comedian Hasan Minhaj, the writer Torrey, and the poet and activist Cleo Wade, talking about a host of issues, and then I'll be on the road having these conversations. I want to share with you a passage from the book that's in the opening chapter on hope. This paragraph is where my heart is right now. It says, "But a belief in tomorrow has never been hollow. It wasn't hollow to those who fought before us. We do not stand in the shadows of those who came before us, but in their glow. And that glow exists because they put forth the vision of the future and they fought for it. We did not invent resistance or discover injustice in August 2014. We exist in a legacy of struggle, a legacy rooted in hope." You know, hope is the fuel for so much of this work. I appreciate and thank you for being along with me and Britt and Clint and Sam and so many other people on this journey. Thanks for supporting the book. Let's go.
Hey, y'all. It's the news. This is Brittany Packnett at Miss Pack Yeti on all social media.
And this is Sam Sinyangwe at Sam Sway on Twitter and Instagram.
This is Clint Smith at Clint Smith the Third.
And this is DeRay at DeRay, D-E-R-A-Y on Twitter.
Oh, did you all spend 8 hours on Friday watching the Queen's funeral services? Because I did. I got dressed in a hat and some fancy shoes and a fancy coat that my mother gifted me because I wanted to get dressed as the Queen, you know, would want me to honor her on that day. But I don't know if you all watched it.
I saw you out here stunting in your, I was your like, new look. Gear. I was like, look at Brittany on the way to church. But you indeed were just in your living room.
Listen, with my, yeah, it was just my living room and I was definitely wearing sweatpants under the coat, but you know, and it, you know, I was, it's August, but still I wanted to honor Aretha Franklin because, yeah, but that's what she deserved. I feel like it was the least I could do, no matter how hot it is. Did you all watch it?
Yeah, good old, it was Cicely Tyson's hat was a spectacle to behold in and of itself.
Listen, it was everything.
And her reading, her dramatic performance was like, Cicely, I do wish that Jennifer Hudson had come earlier because people had left by the time she got there.
Yeah, but she was singing Amazing Grace, right? Which, like, you have to sing right before the eulogy. That eulogy left me with a lot of questions, but most of the rest of the service was wonderful.
It was such a fascinating day because it, you know, you see the McCain, obviously the sort of McCain memorial and McCain funeral was over the course of a few days in different iterations, but I think the two funerals kind of back-to-back represented this really fascinating way, it sort of illuminated the different way that different communities grieve, right? And the different manifestations of mourning in the Black community as compared to the white community. And that's not to say that obviously people in all of those communities mourn the exact same ways. There are a range of different nuances and idiosyncrasies, but it was interesting to sort of watch the two side by side, right? To have what Aretha imagined her going home ceremony to be. And we all know that McCain specifically chose what he wanted his entire funeral to look like. So just as a social scientist in me, I thought that was really interesting to see.
So to what extent was, because I know with McCain, there was all this commentary on how he sort of planned everything out and, you know, didn't invite Trump and, you know, had everything really scripted down to the T. I'm wondering for Aretha, was that also the case, or to what extent was all this sort of pre-planned?
Oh. You know, I don't know exactly, but I cannot believe that as much of a stickler for detail as she was, that she did not have a hand in declaring what she wanted to be true at that funeral service, down to the crossing of her feet in her casket, down to the 24-karat gold casket, down to her wearing a gold sequence gown and gold shoes to match the gold casket. Like, I just, you know, there were multiple costume changes that weekend. Like, she was in multiple outfits, and I just... She paid attention to everything. I can't possibly believe that she didn't have a say in who performed, what they performed, et cetera.
And I still can't believe the Cadillacs.
Oh, yeah, the Cadillacs.
That was incredible. Was that like 100 of them?
The pink Cadillacs? I think so.
She didn't have a will. So, you know, it is unclear how much explicit direction she left with regard to the funeral or anything else. So
that's fair.
It'll be interesting to see how it plays out with the will, given her fortune. You know, $80 million is a lot of money.
85, child. 85.
don't make me miss them five.
Don't,
right.
Don't miss Miss Aretha's okay. Five. And she had probably had $5 million in cash in her pocketbook.
I don't doubt it.
On that last day.
I don't doubt
day.
It at all.
She didn't play games. But rest in peace to the queen, most
And
certainly.
Also, shout out to Tar. Friend Colin Kaepernick, who is the new face of Nike's 30th anniversary of the Just Do It ad.
Pew, pew, pew.
And Colin has, in my mind, and this deserves a longer conversation, in my mind, Colin has already won, right? He's won in the history of how this is going to be remembered. It feels very clear what this moment is going to be remembered by and
yeah,
who stood on what side. And Colin was an amazing quarterback, took his team to the Super Bowl, but what he has done and what he will continue to do with his life moving forward is really just remarkable. And the way that he's carried himself throughout the process, I think, is quite admirable.
I hear that.
You know, Colin didn't say anything. Colin never said anything controversial. He just said the truth. The police are killing people. State violence is real, and it shouldn't be. Nike waited a long time to stand behind Colin. I'm happy that they finally did. It was a long time coming.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
So we are recording this over Labor Day weekend, and part of what I always think about over the course of Labor Day is obviously the broad multiracial coalition of laborers and workers over the course of the past century and even before that, who have worked tirelessly to ensure that we have things like an 8-hour workday and weekends and paid sick leave and all of these things that are incredibly important. The labor movement has had such important, incredible wins throughout the last several decades. But I also think specifically about the unique role that black workers and black laborers and black labor and black folks in labor unions have played throughout the history of the labor movement, because I, you know, labor and the role that labor has played is immensely important. But it's also important that we recognize that black people have had a complicated relationship with unions and a complicated relationship with labor because they were not always welcomed and afforded the benefits that the unions typically afforded the rest of their constituency. And I think a lot about the Pullman Porters, as they were informally known and more formally known as the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. And they were the first African-American labor union to be affiliated with the American Federation of Labor. They were founded in 1925 by A. Philip Randolph. Shout out to A. Philip Randolph. He's the man. And the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters aimed to really improve the working conditions of treatments of black railroad porters and maids who were employed by the Pullman Company, which was a manufacturer and operator of railroads and cars. And just a little bit of history of the organization, just because I think it's really important for folks to have a sense of who they were and what they did, is that in 1867, the founder of the Pullman Company, seized this opportunity to meet the company's labor needs by providing employment for the free slaves who had been freed in the wake of the Civil War. And so these were folks who obviously were in desperate need of employment, and so they were looking for kind of any job that would accept them. But Pullman exploited their difficult situation by demanding long hours and hard work and poor compensation, knowing that they didn't have a lot of ability to push back because they were desperate for any job and for money to put food on their table. And frustrated with the Pullman Company's policies, the Pullman porters went up to Randolph and were essentially like, "You do incredible work. Can you help us form this union? Because we're not getting what we need." And so A. Philip Randolph worked with them, did incredible organizing work. And after about a decade of negotiation, the Pullman Company finally agreed to begin negotiating in good faith with the porters. And on April 25th, 1937, it signed the first agreement between an African-American union, and specifically African-American workers in a union, and a major American corporation. And this was incredibly important because the contract between the Pullman Company and the union brought porters the single largest wage increase that they had ever received under this agreement. And it also secured agreements that established the 240-hour work month, eliminated the system of determining rates by mileage, and guaranteed pay for preparatory and terminal time and a reasonable amount of rest during trips. So all that's to say, the history of this organization is really important. I think it served as the sort of foundation for much of the organizing work that specifically Black folks did over the course of the next several decades. And not a lot of people know who the Pullman porters were. So I think it's important that on a day like Labor Day, we raise them up and the work that they did. Because it is it's so important to having created the labor conditions that we all benefit from today.
Clint, thanks so much for bringing that into the conversation, especially around the holiday that was just celebrated. I always remind people that Labor Day is, in particular, a holiday that was bought with a price, and that it is, in fact, workers who have continued to demand their rights and that their voice be a critical part of negotiations that secured not just that day off, but a lot of the advantages that people who work part-time or full-time enjoy every single day. And we can't take that for granted. A. Philip Randolph in particular is such an important figure. A lot of people don't realize that he and Bayard Rustin were the central organizers of the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, which of course happened 55 years ago last week, August 28th. And so he had an incredibly long and storied career as an organizer and was central to a lot of the freedoms that we enjoy now. And he's a name that so many people don't know. I was taught about him as a very young child, but certainly not in school, but by my parents, by things like Henry Hampton's Eyes on the Prize series, books and other films that made sure that his name was not lost in history. But this is what we mean when we talk about what a travesty it is that in traditional school settings, the only kind of Black historical figures that are often taught are Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks, Harriet Tubman and Malcolm X, if we're lucky. A. Philip Randolph is someone that everyone should know, not just for his work with the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, but for his work in the civil rights movement more broadly. The last thing I'll say is that this is also a reminder that important elections are coming up, and the kinds of freedoms and securities for American workers that people like A. Philip Randolph and plenty of people in the decades since secured for all of us are in jeopardy, especially as we look at states like Wisconsin, where Scott Walker, we know, has systematically and intentionally beat back the rights of unions and of labor and of workers. There are finally better options in Wisconsin. And so it's important to show up during the midterms and make sure that we're not just making a statement about the kind of government we want, but we're making a statement about the ways in which we want workers and labor to be supported. We were able to beat back something called Right to Work in Missouri during this last election cycle. It is erroneously called Right to Work because what it actually does is it helps to dismantle unions as they currently exist. And those are just things we can't afford to see happen. So if you really want to be grateful for Labor Day, if you really want to thank the spirit of A. Philip Randolph, then make sure that you are showing up at the polls, you are educating yourselves about the candidates and the policies and how they will affect American workers, and then you are making decisions to protect them and not to harm them.
Clint, thanks for bringing this up. There were some things I didn't even know about the Pullman Porters and their history, so I appreciate you pushing us always to learn. One of the things that I learned is that Thurgood Marshall was actually the child of a Pullman Porter. And you think about what it means, this legacy of so many people, especially Black people, being in labor unions, especially in a time when Black people were just gaining any sort of political power. I was researching, too, about organized labor in the United States reaching almost its sort of height in 1973. More than one in every three Americans belonged to a labor union, and one-third of that was African-American. It's much less today, but one of the reasons why it sort of peaked in 1973 is that the poverty rate dipped to an all-time low then. And you look at what happens when wages and income require us to think about creating a safety net for people, because the way capitalism works is that a safety net just isn't a part of the deal. And what we know right now is that the wage gap is high, especially with men and women, especially Black women. And we also know that the wealth gap is nearing a record high as well. And we think about what those solutions should be is that when we talk about things like a Poor People's Campaign, when we talk about Fight for 15, all of that in the end is trying to get to a wealth equation that is about equity and justice. So we know that things like reducing debt, when it's focused, actually has an impact. We know that things like K-12 education does a lot of good, doesn't do anything about wealth. We know that homes are the single biggest asset that people can own with regard to wealth, and that we should think about how to give people access to loans so they can buy homes. Like, we know what the solutions look like. The question is, how will we have them function at scale? And I think about my home state of Maryland, where I still live, and you know, Maryland just had a surplus of $500 million at the state level in the same set of years where the school system was fighting for, the school system in Baltimore was like not being funded and had to propose to lay off 1,000 people to just meet ends meet. And I say all that stuff to say that organized labor has been at the forefront of pushing for equity. Most organized labor, you know, we have a thing with the police union, so let's not even act like the police union is not a problem, because the police union is our problem. But the police unions aside, the rest of organized labor has had a traditional legacy of fighting for equity and justice across the board.
So speaking about the police unions, my news is related to that. And that is, in California, the state's legislative session, so the period of time that the legislature is open for business, has just ended. And a couple of really important pieces of legislation were passed, and one really important piece of legislation with regard to policing failed. And so Senate Bill 1421, which, you know, we've talked about some of the bills that have been on the agenda in California. One of those is Senate Bill 1421, which would open records of serious police misconduct. So use of force, police shootings that cause serious injury, as well as sustained complaints of sexual assault or dishonesty by police. So California, again, just to recap, has some of the most restrictive and secretive laws around police misconduct records. One of only three states with a law that specifically prohibits the public from getting access, and even prosecutors from getting access to police misconduct. And now it looks like that's going to change, albeit moderately, by making those serious misconduct files now available if this bill is signed. So 1421 passed the legislature. It's on the governor's desk. We don't yet know if he'll sign it, but if he does, that would open up those critical records to get insight into police misconduct in the state. Another bill that passed this past week was Assembly Bill 748, which requires police departments to release body camera recordings within 45 days. And that is really, really important. We've seen how in many cases, either body camera recordings are not released, or it just takes years and years and years before you see the recording. I'm thinking about, you know, Alton Sterling in Louisiana, for example. So those two bills passed. Those are really important, would do a lot of good. They're sitting on the governor's desk. If you're in California, I encourage you to call the governor's office at 916-445-2841 and tell him to sign those two bills, Senate Bill 1421 and AB 748. So that's the good news. The bad news is Assembly Bill 931, which we've talked about in the past, which would have changed the police deadly force standard to prohibit police from shooting people when it is not necessary. That bill failed. It did not pass the legislature. And so now we are sort of left to wait until the legislature reopens at the beginning of next year before we hopefully can get any action on that. And what's interesting about that bill, you know, it is potentially the single largest and most important and consequential bill with regard to impacting police violence in the state. And not only did it fail, but around the time that it failed, a number of California assembly members received the maximum contribution from police unions. At least 12 assembly members received maximum contributions, $4,400, at the end of August, around the time that this bill was put on hold. So just to give you a sense of why that bill failed, I think that's a big important clue, and it's why we have to continue to be talking about this, raising awareness about these bills, pushing the governor to sign the ones that have passed, and next year, making sure that this AB 931, when it's reintroduced, gets across the finish line.
We spend a lot of time talking about the structural issues, the things that are not as sexy but have a huge impact on the way decisions are made. And the proposed laws that Sam talked about, incredible sets of organizers all around the state have been pushing the legislators to really advocate for them. We also saw that there's a lot of work to be done around the influence of police unions, especially the donations that they are able to provide to, or the fundraising that they're able to provide for legislators. California is one of three states that has made police records virtually impossible to be looked at in any circumstance. So an officer does something bad and it barely comes out in court. It certainly doesn't come out outside of court. It's just like a black hole. And again, that's a level of protection that no other person in public service is afforded. When teachers do things that are wrong, it stays with them. And I say that as somebody who used to run human capital in public education, and certainly in a host of other places with the police. What I'd say, because I don't have anything to add to what Sam said about the specific bills, but what I will say is pay attention that there's this work is happening where you are too. We launched checkthepolice.org a while ago so that people could check the police union contracts. And right now, the Seattle Police Union and the city have gone through a negotiation period to change some parts of the contract, and it didn't go far enough, but there are some seemingly important changes that might help out with accountability. So if you're in Seattle, you should check that out and follow that process really closely. But also around the country, there are some of these contracts are coming up for the negotiating period, and this would be the time to put pressure on your city council or your mayor. They never get pressure about these issues. We have a great case study from Austin where the organizers in Austin pressed and the whole city council voted against a police union contract because the clauses just didn't make sense, and the organizers got people together to pay attention to something that seems really wonky but has a huge impact on the way people experience a policing community. So, you know, some of the legislative stuff isn't very sexy, but it is important. And the last thing is that we actually sent in a set of recommendations with the Baltimore City Community Oversight Task Force. They had recommendations about community oversight in Baltimore. We wrote a letter outlining some things that we thought should be important. And I say that because these are things that aren't as sexy, but they matter. And you'd be shocked at the level of policies and rules that really are what we're up against.
You know, when I sat on President Obama's task force for 21st century policing, we talked a great deal about the importance of transparency. When we were kind of negotiating our final recommendations, I was very clear with the entire task force that the transparency of investigations, that the need for external and independent prosecutions and investigations was something that I was going to go to the mat for, because it was one of the things that my community was very clear that they demanded for the future. And while this isn't all of that, this is certainly a step in the right direction if this goes through. Because the idea that police can police themselves is incredibly dangerous, especially if, as to DeRay's point, you've got entire systems that are entrenched and have been for years and decades and centuries in not being transparent and not being open with the community, and doing so in order to protect officers, often to the detriment of community members. And so I'm thankful to see this moving. And a lot of people, as DeRay said, ask why we spend time on the minutia, on the policy details, on all of the things that I think people want to readily ignore and just go for more simple solutions. And yet these are the things that matter a great deal. This is how we continue to create marks in the armor, and this is how we continue to push the ball forward. Now on to less positive news. As this drops, we will be readying ourselves for the confirmation hearings of Brett Kavanaugh, who is, of course, the nominee to the Supreme Court to fill Justice Kennedy's seat. When Justice Kennedy left, he left a seat open where, when he occupied it, he was clearly on, in my opinion, the wrong side of history about a lot of things, but about 11% of the time actually ruled in favor of progressive issues, things like marriage equality, etc. And so we're going very potentially from someone who was with us 11% of the time to someone who will be with us 0% of the time in Judge Kavanaugh. Here's what we know thus far about Brett Kavanaugh. We know that his name was one of several on a list from the Federalist Society. And if you don't know anything about the Federalist Society, they are an ultra-right-wing conservative think tank that tends not to agree with anything that most of us believe who listen to this podcast. The Federalist Society created a list of potential Supreme Court nominees that included all judges who would promise to overturn Roe versus Wade. Interestingly, though, not only has Brett Kavanaugh made it clear that he would overturn Roe versus Wade, the precedent that protects the right to choose for women across this country, Brett Kavanaugh also doesn't believe that a sitting president can be indicted. And as you and I both know, Donald Trump is currently an unindicted co-conspirator in potentially many crimes. So it strikes me as very odd that that is the name that they would pick off of this list, someone who believes that Donald Trump can commit these crimes and not face any punishment for them, and someone who's going to promise to overturn Roe versus Wade. But here's the worst part. On top of all of that, we have not even seen his entire resume. Now, I don't know about y'all, but for every job I have applied for, they have wanted to have multiple interviews. They have seen everything I've ever written, tweeted, Facebooked. They've seen my entire resume. And in the over 200,000 pages that we have of records from Brett Kavanaugh's time working in the Bush administration, there are 100,000 of those pages that the Trump administration is still keeping hidden from all of us. If you compare that to the kind of combing through of records that Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan experienced, there honestly is no comparison. I mean, they went through every single thing that they had ever written, even scraps of paper and napkins, in order to find out what they were about and find out if they were actually confirmable. And so at the end of the day, I don't know how we could possibly, as the American people, be okay with senators who work for us confirming someone that we do not know everything about to a lifetime job. And Brett Kavanaugh is relatively young. He could be on the court for decades and wreak havoc on marginalized communities for a long time to come. And it's not just the pro-choice movement that is having this conversation, because Brett Kavanaugh also poses a threat to voting rights, to immigration rights, and much, much more. Two really important things. One, if Roe versus Wade is overturned, abortions don't end. They simply become more dangerous. In fact, in the year before Roe versus Wade was decided, 90% of New York women who died from unsafe illegal abortions were Black and Latina, which not only means that those procedures were much more dangerous, but it is the most marginalized women who will suffer. This is not just about abortion. It's about bodily autonomy. Historically, women of color, disabled women, immigrant women, and poor women have all had this stripped away from us at the whim of wealthy white people who don't even have a uterus. So your senator should absolutely refuse to confirm an unvetted and, from every indication we have thus far, incredibly dangerous candidate in Brett Kavanaugh.
You know, watching this whole Supreme Court confirmation, hopefully not confirmation, process has been sickening. And frankly, I mean, it's been so frustrating to see Republicans, after seeing everything that they did to Merrick Garland, preventing him from becoming a Supreme Court justice, which, by the way, would have fundamentally altered everything that we're seeing under this administration and potentially rendered everything that has been done unconstitutional and inoperable. Instead of that, we have a potential second Supreme Court pick from the Trump administration. And so seeing what they're doing with these pages of documents, so George W. Bush's attorney said, his name is Bill Burke, he said that they had essentially compiled all the documents that they wanted to withhold, that should have been withheld, and then the Trump administration actually said that that was actually not good enough, that there were documents that Bush's attorney said were cool to release that the Trump administration doesn't even want to release, that they're keeping secret intentionally. And the question is, what's in those documents? Kavanaugh, you know, 100,000 pages of his records are being withheld, citing presidential privilege. And, you know, these are records that involve his time serving in the Bush White House. And I know that, you know, over this past weekend, we saw a whole lot of, I would say, bad takes on President Bush and, you know, bipartisanship and, you know, saying that he was a good guy and definitely better than the current president. And we need to remember that George W. Bush and his administration engaged in an illegal war that ended up killing almost a million people and engaged in torture and all kinds of other unconstitutional behavior, some of which Kavanaugh was involved in, right? And so how do you withhold those? Those are the records that they are most likely withholding. And so, you know, it's really important that we get access to this. And it's important that in thinking about who this nominee is, it's not just that his resume, parts of it are being hidden, but those are the potentially the most nefarious parts from some of the most nefarious periods of time in our nation's history. And so it's critical that we get access to these documents. And the last thing I'll say is, you know, we saw the Republicans play games with Merrick Garland and the first Trump nomination. Now we're seeing them do this again. And just the prospect of seeing all of these games being played, seeing them throw out all the rules in getting people nominated to the Supreme Court and confirmed, and then asking the rest of us to just sit there and accept the rules and let these people serve for the rest of their lives on a court when they shouldn't have been appointed or confirmed in the first place is ludicrous to me. So, you know, I think taking a step back, it is something that we should be talking about, impeachment. We should be thinking about, you know, it is possible for a Supreme Court justice to be impeached and removed. It is possible to actually correct for some of the tricks that Republicans are playing today. And all of that should be on the table in 2020 because, you know, you can't just play all these games, rig the system in your favor, and then ask the rest of us to follow the rules that you created and the precedents that you set in order to keep yourself in power. So I'm going to just say that right now because I haven't heard enough of talk about, you know, what do we actually do about this in a substantive way?
Yeah. You know, well, I think Sam laid it out so well, and so did Brittany. You know, the only thing I'll add is that this is, as Sam alluded to, like, this is far from an insignificant portion of Kavanaugh's career, right? Like, this is a 3-year period in which he worked in, despite what our sort of contemporary revisionist history will tell you about the Bush administration, was one of the most egregious, dangerous, and violent periods in American history, specifically, but not singularly, with regard to foreign policy. And it is quite possible that Brett Kavanaugh was directly involved in making decisions around the legitimation of torture, domestic surveillance, discrimination in marriage, and things that are run profoundly counter to the way that we conceive of who we want to be and who we aspire to be as a country. And the idea that we would not have access to 3 years worth of documents that might implicate this potential Supreme Court judge with a life appointment that would implicate him in having potentially participated in some of the most horrific parts of our history as a country is incredibly unsettling and is in many ways unprecedented, right? And we are in an unprecedented moment in a million and one ways, right? We haven't even talked about the fact that the president of the United States is an unindicted co-conspirator in a crime, right? In a crime that is ongoing, and that we may have answers to soon, but we may not have answers to for a while. as has been the case for a year and a half, there are a range of factors that show us that we should be far more judicious than we're being, and that if we're not, the potential consequences are incredibly far-reaching.
So my news is about Mississippi. 15 inmates in Mississippi, 15 people have been incarcerated in Mississippi, have died in the month of August, ranging in ages from 24 to 75. That is a lot of people to die in jail in general, but definitely in a concentrated period. The cause of death of the prisoners has not been officially released, but they have unofficially said that it was natural causes. And it's like, I don't even, okay, like that is sort of wild. And they have asked the FBI to step in to help the Mississippi Department of Public Safety to assist in the investigation of the deaths. The FBI released a statement last week saying that they would examine the facts and see if any inmates' civil rights have been violated. Now, I bring this up because, you know, it's bad enough to be incarcerated. It's another thing when something is happening inside of the prisons and jails that is inexplicable. Besides, there's like a lapse in security, in process, in something. And to give you context, Mississippi averaged 51 inmate deaths per year from 2001 to 2014, or an average about 4 deaths a month. So having 15 in 1 month is just sort of like it's so wild that it almost, when I read this story, I thought it was a mistake. I was like, oh, 15 people died this year in Mississippi, which is bad in and of itself. And then it was like 15 deaths in 1 month. Something has to be wrong. So the ACLU, a lot of people are paying attention to what's happening. Some people think that it might be extreme heat because of the temperatures rising in the South because of climate change. Some people think that there might be something else going on. I don't know, but this requires a deeper conversation, both about mass incarceration and about the health of inmates.
DeRay, you mentioned that data on deaths in state and federal prisons. And, you know, looking at the study from the Bureau of Justice Statistics, what they find is that there have been about 50,000 people who have died in state or federal prison between 2001 and 2014. And they attribute the vast majority of those, about 45,000 of the 50,000, to quote-unquote natural causes. But what you mentioned there, DeRay, and what we know to be true is that in many cases, what is deemed natural causes is not natural at all, but something that is caused by the environment that people are being subjected to while they're being incarcerated, by the choices that are made. So we've heard about folks who've been incarcerated with no access to air conditioning in 100-degree weather in the South, right? We've heard about, in the previous episode, we heard how prisons are located near environmental waste dumps in places that are so toxic that it contributes to negative health consequences and potentially even death. And so, you know, it's important when the state sort of pushes back against claims that something nefarious is going on within the prisons that are causing these deaths and says, you know, that's just natural causes. Oftentimes, the natural causes aren't natural at all, and in fact are very intentional and could have been prevented had this system valued the lives of the people that had been in prison in the first place.
And part of what this brings up for me is the fact that Mississippi spends such a small amount on their health care for those who are incarcerated as compared to the national average. So Mississippi spends on average about $3,770, to be specific, according to the Pew Charitable Trust. And the national median is $5,720. So Mississippi is spending about $2,000 less per incarcerated person than that median of the entire nation. And that's important for a range of reasons, but part of what it makes me think about is that oftentimes we have this conversation around interest convergence in the conversation and discourse around mass incarceration. And we're like, oh, well, people on the right are interested in the fact that we spend $80 billion a year on incarcerating people. And we need to, you know, if you're a fiscal conservative, you're interested in reducing the amount of money that we spend on prison. And if you're somebody on the left, you are, you know, disillusioned and frustrated with the carceral state as an entity and its history of oppression and racism, et cetera, et cetera. And that if we can meet in the middle and recognize that we both have an interest in ostensibly creating a smaller prison system at least, creating a smaller prison system that decarcerates fewer people, that is the sort of logic that flows from that, right? That we will then, if this group of people want to spend less money and this group of people want the system to be smaller, then if they come together, we can begin to massively decarcerate the population. And that's not to say that you should not work with people on the other side, but I think something that is important to know is that when people frame things purely from an economics standpoint, there are a lot of ways to save money in the realm and in the context of incarceration that don't include letting people out, right? I think that sometimes people think that, oh, well, if we spend, the way to spend less money is to let more people out of prison and put less people in. That is true, but you can also spend less money on food. You can spend less money on healthcare. You can spend less money on correctional officers. You can spend less money on a whole range of things that actually affect the quality of life of the people in the prisons. And then you have somewhere like Mississippi who's spending $2,000 less than national median on their healthcare costs in ways that simply cannot be peripheral to a conversation concerning.
Save on quality sofas, sectionals, top brand mattresses, and more during Haverty's President's Day sale. Find the style of furniture you've been looking for at Haverty's, online or in Columbus at Polaris.
Why does every recipe I try need 18 ingredients, including a jar of something paste I'll never use again but will sit in my fridge for 9 months? I just want dinner in the oven, fast. That's why I love Blue Apron's new one-pan assemble and bake meals. They send you fresh ingredients that are already chopped. All you do is put it all together and bake. That's it. No chopping, no weird leftovers, just delicious, easy-to-make meals. Get 20% off your first two orders with code APRON20. Terms and conditions apply. Visit blueapron.com/terms for more.
I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Forget whatever plans you have this weekend because you're staying at home and playing on SpinQuest. And there's never been a better time to sign up than right now. New users get $30 coin packs for just $10. All the table games you love with hundreds of slot games and real cash prizes. That's at SpinQuest.com. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
A large amount of prisoners who are dying in this state. So I think that that's just something for us to keep in mind, and that we have to push the conversation beyond its seemingly sort of beyond its economic imperatives and really ground our conversations around mass incarceration and efforts to decarcerate in through a moral framework.
That's the news.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Don't go anywhere. There's more to come.
And now, my conversation with Tish James.
Tish James.
Yo.
Thank you for joining us today on Party of the People.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Now, where are you from?
Brooklyn.
What part?
So, I was born in Park Slope.
Okay.
And I live in Clinton Hill.
Got it. I taught in East New York in Start City.
Oh, sure. Know it well.
Yeah, yeah.
Know it well.
And you are the public advocate.
Correct.
Can you explain what that means to people who are like, yeah, what is the public advocate?
Because there is no public advocate. There's no elected public advocate elsewhere in this nation. There's some appointed public advocates, but I'm the only elected public advocate, which is a checks and balance on the mayor of the city of New York, second in line to the mayor.
Okay.
So checks and balances on the mayor. We have jurisdiction over city agencies, provide transparency and accountability, making sure they're meeting the needs of New Yorkers and following up on services, providing them with services. Serve on the NYSERS board, which is the city's pension board. Okay. Also have the ability to introduce legislation in the city council, preside over the city council at their stated council meetings, and have the ability to initiate litigation. So, and if anything should happen to the governor right now, I would become mayor automatically.
If anything would happen to the mayor.
Correct.
Got it. So it seems like you're like the behind the scenes, making sure things don't break and making sure that the government's sort of running. What would be something that what would be something that the public advocate has done that like people didn't know was the work of the public advocate?
So we're not really behind the scenes. We're sort of up in your face.
Okay.
And so we've been in the forefront on protecting the rights of tenants. Okay. Here in the city of New York. So we have brought great attention to landlords who are harassing tenants and who are evicting tenants by any means necessary. So they're evicting them by construction, by harassment, by violating rules, and just trying to raise the rents because of these market forces, which is having an impact on low income and people of color in the city of New York. As you know, in certain neighborhoods, actually all throughout the city of New York, we've got gentrification on steroids. And so it's resulting in the great displacement of a number of low-income residents here in the city of New York and significant number of people of color, which is why in the city tonight we've got 70,000 New Yorkers who are homeless. New York is becoming too expensive and the rent is too high.
And you were the first African-American woman elected to citywide office.
Yeah, it's pretty sad commentary that here we are in the 21st century. I'm the first black woman elected citywide.
That is sort of wild.
That's pretty sad.
What has it been like to be a trailblazer in that respect and hold office in a city, the biggest city in the country?
So I haven't really focused on being a trailblazer because it's nothing more than a historical footnote. Because I know a lot of people with titles who do absolutely nothing with it. Mm-hmm. So for me, it's really about producing results and representing the interest of marginalized communities and invisible communities and making sure that government works for them and that their voices are heard and that they have a seat at the table.
How's your identity inform the way that you think about the issues and the way you think about the work?
Clearly, obviously, who I am, an African-American woman, obviously has formed and influenced my thinking on a lot of issues, particularly social justice. As someone who used to work as a public defender and as someone who's seen and tasted and felt discrimination and racism, I know it up front. I know it close. I know it intimately. And so obviously want to make sure that all individuals are respected in this city and in this state and in this country and that rights are protected. That's the reason why I became an attorney and the reason why I went to the school that I did, Howard University. Shout out to Howard. It's my reason for getting up each and every day, you know, fighting for the little guy.
I love it. Now, before we go to your next run, I wanted to ask about the recent bills before the New York City Council about ride sharing and the cab.
Uber.
And Lyft.
And
Juno.
And all the others.
All the others.
Yeah.
What was your, I had somebody from Lyft on here.
Yep.
And I haven't had anybody from the city, so,
yeah,
you know,
sure.
You are an elected official in the
right.
City. What was your take?
So I didn't have a vote, but I presided over that hearing. And what I heard was the stories of taxi drivers, and some of their family members were in the chamber at the time. Their family members, their loved ones who committed suicide because they couldn't make ends meet. On average, they earned around $30,000. And so they've been put at a severe disadvantage. The license that they held, the franchise that they held, the permit that they got, they were sold a bill of goods. They were told that it, you know, would be worth a lot of money, that it would provide them an opportunity to gain entry to the middle class. In reality, it hasn't. And part of it is because others have entered into the market and they've had to work from sunup to sundown. And so a number of them have committed suicide. And so basically there's this bill puts a moratorium on any additional licenses for a lot of these other services. And there was a lot of, you know, dissent from a lot of these other hail services. Others argue that yellow cabs don't go into communities of color and that there's great discrimination. And with Uber and Lyft, et cetera, that's one way to remove that discrimination. And so it's a double-edged sword, and it's difficult. And I think we're going to study the industry at this point in time and try to come up with measures to address discrimination and to provide opportunities for those who want to be a part of the hail service, and look at these medallions, which are worthless right now to these yellow taxi drivers. Lastly, another argument that was made in support of this legislation, this moratorium, was congestion in Midtown and climate change and clean air. So all these arguments were made. I mean, at the end of the day, the speaker decided to move this bill forward so that it can be studied, so that the industry can be studied, and so that we could accommodate the needs of all interested parties. And the bill passed.
I will say, I hope, you know, I don't know what your role as a public advocate is around the taxi and limousine commission, but as somebody who, and I will bet my everything that you've had an experience where a taxi wouldn't pick you up, is that it was sort of surprising to see the mayor and
The speaker
come out and talk about the new Office of Inclusion, which I'm like, pro, sign me up. But the Office of Inclusion seems to have a largely education role. And like, I just think it's sort of, it seems sort of wild to suggest that the taxi drivers just don't know that they need to be educated that discrimination is bad and doesn't seem to come with any enforcement power. So it seems like it, and I'm totally willing to be challenged on this, but it seems like lip service that like, if you actually thought discrimination was bad, it didn't like just get bad with the ride sharing cap. It seemed, it was been bad for, you know, it's been back for a long time.
Don't point at me a long time. So,
that was shady. Y'all didn't see that. I'm struggling with that part of it.
And plus, given the fact that we've got the Human Rights Commission, which does have enforcement powers, why the need for another agency? You know, it begs the question. There's no question about it.
With
no additional resources, and it's duplicative, some argue. So I understand your argument, but at the same time, you know, we've had a number of, what do you say to the drivers, the families of the drivers who committed suicide because they just can't make ends meet?
That's a good question. And, you know, Uber and Lyft offered that $100 million to try and offset it, and that would be something to say to them, right? And
right.
What I do think is true is that people started using the apps because of experiences with taxis.
Yeah.
And that, like, this is what markets do, right? Is that when, like, you
change.
Yeah, but you're like, because I'll never forget the last time I was out, it was like 3:00 in the morning. All these white kids had just gotten out of the bar. I'm like clearly standing in the middle of the street, and they just
like, you can't get a cab.
I just can't get a cab. You know, and it's like,
they didn't recognize you.
They were not checking for me or anybody that looked like me, you know? And like, that is what happens.
That's what happens.
So it is like a, you know, sometimes industries die and they are reborn because of what happened. So, and I'm
sure,
you know, like, people need to make a living wage. Like, sign me up for that. Yeah. I just don't know if it's, I think it is not fair to suggest that the suicide's a result of the ride apps just, like, showing up in the world.
Well, I think part of it is because they left notes behind. It's the economics of it all. And two, congestion is a major problem in the city of New York. And I guess the argument can be made, well, we need to do a congestion tax. We need to limit deliveries. We need to put tolls on some of our bridges. So that those are some of the arguments that have been made to deal with congestion and not to disrupt an industry which serves everyone and addresses the issue of discrimination. And so I'm not saying that Lyft and Uber are going anywhere. They're still on the street. You can still, you know, go on your app and get an Uber right now. All that we are doing is right now halting things, studying it, and see where things are in the future. So okay. That's all that we're doing. Just wait and see.
Okay.
But you can still get your
Uber. And it's like, why is there a cap before the study? That feels like the taxi industry is sort of moving things behind the scenes. And you didn't vote. So I, you know, so this isn't even, this is really me just like,
no, this advocate. this is a good philosophical discussion.
I'm just saying.
I'm all I'm saying is you can still get your app. It's a cap right now. It's just a wait and see moment. Let's just study the industry. And I suspect that there'll be litigation.
I'm all about it. I will say, too, this is, I only know because on this episode of the podcast, this is my news, is that there's actually a historic decrease in driver's licenses, the lowest number of driver's licenses. It's like the biggest decrease that has been recorded. Sort of wild for 16-year-olds and 19-year-olds. It's like down 20-40% since 1983. So people aren't getting driver's licenses. And most people suspect that it's because of the ride-sharing apps and things like that. Yeah. And it actually isn't. So when you survey the people, it's only like 17% sort of give a suggestion that it's because of like public transportation or another mode of transportation. Most people, it's like they can't afford it or just don't need it. It's fascinating. Okay, now...
But you know what also we need to do? We need to fix MTA.
Oh. And as Attorney General, what could you do about that?
I mean, we can look into the finances of the MTA because there's still a question as to whether or not they still have cooking the books.
I don't know about this. Well, let me just transition. Sure. So for those of you listening that don't know, Tish is running to be the next Attorney General of the great state of New York.
News flash.
So tell me about, I don't know, you know, people are really, they are paying attention to what's happening with MTA. Tell me, I never heard the cooking the books thing.
Yeah, there was a report done years ago by a former controller, John Liu, which discovered that in fact, MTA had two sets of books. And so we need to look at the MTA. We need to look at their finances because the system, there's an increasing number of individuals who are riding the MTA, particularly in neighborhoods that have resulted in increased residential development, like Williamsburg and Greenpoint and downtown Brooklyn. And the MTA system needs to be corrected and fixed and improved, and it needs to be more reliable. And the conditions need to change, and unfortunately.
And you could do something, you could investigate the books as Attorney General.
Yeah, we can look at it and see whether or not your fares are actually going to capital improvements or they're going elsewhere.
Now, why Attorney General? Why not another office in New York City? Or why Attorney General?
So we all know that our former Attorney General had to step down based on some allegations of some women, sexual harassment and assaults, et cetera. So there's a vacancy. It happened less than 3 months ago. And at the time, I was thinking about another office, mayor, but that's 2021. But given this pivotal point in our history, given where we are right now, given the current occupant of the White House, given the attacks on immigrants, given the attacks on women, the attacks on people of color, given all that I've been trained as a social engineer, as a social justice attorney, this is a culmination of my professional and legal career. And so I've decided to run for the office of Attorney General. And if I get elected on September 13th, I'll be the second black female Attorney General elected in this nation.
Wow. Who was the first?
The California United States.
Oh, Kamala.
Kamala Harris.
Yes.
Who was also from Howard University.
Uh-oh. Look at y'all. Now, I saw the criminal justice platform that you released. And one of the things that was unexpected and that I, in a good way, was that you talk about the secrecy law around police records, which nobody, you know, we talk about this a lot and people act like I'm making it up. But then I saw your platform. I was like, okay, Tish. Yeah. So for people that don't know about the secrecy law, can you explain it for a second and why you are coming out saying that it is not necessarily a good thing?
So individuals who are involved in criminal actions, or who are involved in investigations, their records are not subject to the sunlight. Police specifically, and they're shrouded in secrecy. And so individuals cannot obtain their records to determine whether or not this police officer had previous complaints filed against him, had disciplinary actions filed against him, was involved in other street encounters which resulted in the death of individuals. It's shrouded in secrecy, and that's just not right. And so it's critically important that, for instance, Pantaleo, who was involved in the death of Eric Garner, in the event that he's brought up on disciplinary charges, and he will be, and hopefully dismissed or terminated from the force, that we can't obtain his records, his previous records. There's just something wrong with that when we know that if you were arrested today, or if I was arrested today, if we had a criminal record, it would be on the front page of the paper.
Everybody would
tomorrow.
Know.
Everyone right. would know. And it's just not right. And so all we want is fairness. And all we want is transparency. And all we want is sunlight.
The other thing that I read that was notable was about the prosecutor's role in these cases, the special prosecutor or the attorney general's role. Can you just explain the importance? You specifically highlight the importance of codifying it and not just having it be wrapped up in an executive order. Can you explain why you think that some people would say it's already an executive order. The last attorney general was against it, but like it's in the executive order. Why does this matter?
So this was in the aftermath of Eric Garner, and we, the Office of Public Advocate, we originally wrote a letter to the attorney general and to the governor asking that he appoint a special prosecutor to be appointed in cases involving civilian death at the hands of the police. Governor responded, appointed Eric Schneiderman, but it's not a standing order and it's not codified, it's not permanent.
Okay.
It's temporarily, can be terminated tomorrow. And so what we want is a permanent order designating the attorney general, hopefully Letitia James, and the next attorney general, whoever that may be, as a special prosecutor in cases of police-involved shootings.
In all the jurisdictions in the state?
All 62 counties.
Got it. Now, would you consider legislation that prohibited officers who were dismissed for a range of things from being hired in another jurisdiction?
It's something we haven't considered, but obviously it's an issue that we should look at. The Office of Attorney General has the ability to introduce program bills, legislative proposals to the state legislature, just like the Public Advocate's Office. And obviously advocacy is going to be a big part of the Office of Attorney General going forward. Let me also say that there is a bill currently pending before the governor right now. It's a bill which has been put forth by Assemblymember Nick Perry, who is the chair of the Black and Puerto Rican and Asian Caucus in the state legislature, which would basically provide some checks and balances on prosecutors, particularly given all the cases that we are seeing resulting in prosecutorial misconduct.
And this is modeled after an existing body.
Correct. And it's on the governor's desk.
Explain the prosecutor. So for people that don't,
right.
You spend a lot of time in the legal world.
Yeah.
What it seems like you're arguing is that there's some prosecutors who are withholding evidence, who
yes.
are just engaged in what we would consider to be misconduct, and that there currently isn't an apparatus to hold them accountable
Correct.
In any substantive way.
And this bill would hold them accountable. So let's say a district attorney has exculpatory evidence which would suggest that the individual who is currently facing charges
didn't do it. Okay,
And they're withholding that for whatever reason. And then this individual is convicted and stays in jail for 25, 30 years, something like that. This would provide some accountability to the prosecutor in question. And
right now what happens?
Nothing.
Literally nothing or just not a lot?
Just nothing. You can't sue. They're immune. They're immune. There's nothing. I guess you can sue civilly, but nothing happens to that prosecutor. You get some a judgment, you get some resources, you get some money, and that's it.
You get a settlement from the state or something.
From the state, but nothing happens to the prosecutor in question. Not even a slap on the wrist, nothing. And so there has to be some sort of accountability. And so
who's fighting against this?
Well, there was a newspaper today that came out against it, or yesterday, I should say. Of course, the district attorney's coalition are opposed to it, and it's on the governor's desk, and we are urging the governor of the state of New York to sign that bill.
Has Cynthia Nixon said anything about it?
I believe Cynthia Nixon supports it.
Okay. I will send you and your team. Nebraska has a really interesting bill.
Okay. Nebraska?
I know. Who knew? With the Republican governor. Around not letting officers who've been engaged in misconduct travel. Around to other jurisdictions. I also was shocked about Nebraska, but it passed.
Go Nebraska.
Mm-hmm. On this issue. Governor has some other issues that we're not so proud of, but this one is interesting. Also, immigration is a
yes.
big part of your, and New York City is a...
Sanctuary city.
Yep, sanctuary city. And a place where the immigration conversation just means something different than other places. So I'd love to know what I read it. But I'll start with what do you think the Attorney General can do in the face of ICE, in the face of Sessions, in the face of Trump? Is it only cosmetic things? Like, is it like, you know, all the, releasing a million statements, being like, no, you protect people?
We could push back and protect the rights of New Yorkers. It's really all about states' rights, and it's also about enforcing federal laws, because we do know that the federal government, unfortunately, is closed for business. And so we've got to, one, protect the ability to serve as a sanctuary city and not be penalized financially. This administration would like for New York City to lose funds as a result of New Yorkers standing up for the rights of immigrants. We need to make sure that ICE is removed from our courthouses, individuals, immigrants who go to court to get an order of protection or witnesses in cases. It has a chilling effect on...
How do you make sure they're removed? Like, what's the mechanism?
So right now what we are doing, the federal government, unfortunately, they are embedded in our courts all across the state of New York. And seizing immigrants and in some cases, you know, deporting them and reporting their status. And so what we would like to do is challenge the ability of the federal government to come into our state courts and do just that.
You'd like to sue them?
Yes.
Oh, because you can't just like straight up ban them.
No. We would have to initiate litigation. And then obviously there's a proposal right now where they're contemplating a proposal. So individuals, immigrants who applied for, let's say, food stamps or public assistance, that would be a means to denying you a green card. And we think that's wrong because that penalizes.
Explain it to me.
You applied for any type of public benefits.
Oh, you're like stealing from the government in their mind.
Right. And therefore you would be a...
they are just...
Yeah. I guess the notion is if you previously relied upon public benefits and you now become a citizen or you a resident, then you, I guess, would continue to be a dependent upon state services or public services. I guess that's the notion.
So you would sue to get this change, or is there another mechanism to do that?
No, it would all be litigation. It would all be litigation challenging this administration on a number of its practices. And I just think that individuals who get services are not getting it because... they want to be dependent upon government. It's because of their standing, their economic standing at that point in time, and they need an assistance at that point in time. And we should not be discriminated against low-income individuals or individuals who are living in poverty who basically need some assistance from time to time. I think that's wrong. And that should not be a bar to getting your citizenship and or a green card and or an asylum petition. Seeking an asylum petition. We should stand up for DACA. I represented an unaccompanied minor here in the city of New York, a young child who came from Honduras fleeing violence, whose parents unfortunately were murdered in Honduras, came to this country, and we did an asylum petition, which was granted. And
as a public advocate, or like as a
private citizen, as an attorney, I did it pro bono, and his petition was granted, and he just graduated from high school and is doing great. I also filed a petition as public advocate and as a private citizen on behalf of a child who was separated from their parent. We did a habeas corpus petition. That petition was granted. The mother and her child, her daughter, were reunited. But unfortunately, now they face deportation. And what we're trying to do is assist them in getting an asylum petition, even though this federal government is limiting individuals' rights to seek asylum in our country.
Can you explain one thing? So there's a part in the immigration platform that talks about protecting 19 to 21-year-old children.
Those are the unaccompanied minor, and as part of the DACA process.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
So that's what we were doing. Okay. And so what they would like to do is end that program. And there's a significant number of...
Can you explain this for me? Can you explain it for everybody? What's a 21-year-old child? That's what I was like...
So there's two... So I think people are confused. There's a lot of confusion.
I'm confused.
Okay.
I'm confused. Blame me.
There's a group of individuals who came to this country who were fleeing violence and persecution.
Yes.
And those individuals were protected under DACA, which is what this president would like to eliminate.
Yes.
And they cover individuals between the ages of 19 and 21.
Got it.
And so that's one group of young people. Then there's another group of young people who, as you know, have been separated from their parents.
Yes.
And in some cases, their parents self-deported were deported by this administration. And what we are trying to do is reunify these children. And in some cases, it's very, very difficult. And this administration, unfortunately, is challenging the rights of so many New Yorkers, but particularly immigrants. He's rolling back all of the progress that we have made on women's rights, on the environment, which is why it's so critically important that individuals vote in the midterm elections. Because if he should be successful in nominating this Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court, a lot of the progress that we've made in this country as people of color, as immigrants, as people of good conscience is just going to be rolled back.
Now, there's so many things that the public advocate does that most people don't know, but has a huge impact on their daily lives.
Yeah.
What are some of the things, or are there things that the Attorney General does that people like don't think that that is like what the Attorney General does, but it's an important function?
So let me explain the Attorney General's office. So 60% of what the Attorney General does is state defensive work. You represent state agencies. So you trip and fall on state property, you put in a claim, the Attorney General goes in and, you know, defends state property.
Or somebody sues like the Department of Education or something.
Right, or you sue the Department of Correction. It's the Attorney General
and
who steps
in.
Right, or they seize your home. Let's say a state wants to seize your home and build a road. It's the Attorney General who defends that right.
Got it.
So that's...
Don't be seizing people's homes,
well, they,
Tish.
They,
come
well,
on.
Well,
kidding.
Well, you know, well, that, like, for instance, in downtown Brooklyn, at the arena, they seized homes to build that arena.
Oh, they did. Yeah,
they did.
Mm-hmm.
They did, so.
Were you public advocate then?
No, I was a city council member then who fought that. So most of it is defensive work. Not sexy work, doesn't get a lot of attention, but that's the majority of the work of the Attorney General. Then there's the affirmative litigation, and that's like patent and practice cases. Okay, somebody upstate is discriminating against a member of the LGBT community. Someone's discriminated against an African-American, and they're doing it repeatedly in a county or something like that, affirmative litigation. A business is defrauding consumers, affirmative litigation. A housing policy that says if you are disabled, you can't rent this apartment. Then there's the advocacy work where you lobby on behalf of your program bills, the bills that I mentioned, the bills to close like the pardon loophole. This president wants to pardon individuals from federal crimes. The state attorney general could step in and still prosecute that individual for state crimes.
And is that not possible now?
No, there's a loophole, and that's why we
just for the state. This just for New York, or like in every place?
It's for New York. I can't speak about any other states, okay. But I know in New York there's a particular loophole that we need to close to allow individuals not to be pardoned for state crimes. So there's also the bills that we spoke of, like for instance, this. It's not an attorney general's program bill. But for instance, a bill to address the criminal justice system, which is sponsored by the Attorney General's office. So there's advocacy work, bills that need to be passed in the state legislature. And then there's lastly enforcement. We need to enforce environmental laws. We need to force reproductive laws. We need to force health laws, healthcare laws.
What does the Attorney General do around enforcement? Give me an example.
So let's just say there's dumping on Long Island. I went to Long Island recently, and there's businesses that are dumping in public spaces in communities of color.
Okay.
And so we need to enforce environmental laws. We need to go after this
business.
So
you'd go sue them?
Yes, we would go
sue
them.
Got it.
So that's basically what the Attorney General does.
How many lawyers?
There is over 650 attorneys. It's one of the largest law firms in this country. It's the preeminent law enforcement agency in the state, and I would argue in this nation.
And where are the headquarters? Are they here or are they in?
So their primary office is located in Manhattan.
Okay.
But they have regional offices all throughout the state of New York. So just about in every major city, there is a regional office in Albany. In Buffalo, there's an office in Syracuse.
But when you win, your office will be in Manhattan.
It will be in Manhattan, but I'm going to work very closely with the regional offices. I previously served as the head of the Brooklyn regional office because a lot of people think Brooklyn is, you know, is a city. It's so large. So there's a Brooklyn regional office. There's a Harlem regional office.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So there's an Albany regional offices. And so there's regional offices all over the state.
And what do you think qualifies you to do this work, given that it'll be so different than the roles that you've had before?
Well, to a certain extent, it's not because I'm a former public defender. I've defended a countless number of people in the criminal justice system, defending the Constitution, because I believe when people are at their lowest, they still need to be defended because no one's above the law and no one's too low to be below the law. Two, I'm a former assistant attorney general. I worked in the office as head of the regional office. I've been involved in cases primarily in Brooklyn where individuals were victims of predatory lending. And there's a lot of deed theft in Brooklyn.
When my grandma dies and somebody rewrites the name on the deed.
Yeah, and take, right, exactly. Then there's
that's like a thing? Like people do that a lot?
They do it quite a bit.
Who knew?
And it's happening a lot in central Brooklyn.
How do you stop deed theft? I know this is a tangent, but I'm just curious.
So what we have done in the city council, it basically says whenever anyone transfers property, now you have to be notified by the local agency. In the past, you weren't notified. So you could literally walk and say, I'm Mr. B, I own this house, at da 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 da, and you transfer it to somebody. And in the past, whenever there was a transfer of a deed, no one was notified. It just happened. And then people would get mortgages off those homes.
That is wild.
Yeah. And so now you got to be notified.
Okay.
So a simple notification. But unfortunately, it still happens. Because notices are sent to individuals at the building in question. And let's say you live in Florida, but you own property in Brooklyn.
That is, who knew? I need to ask them. I need to get a deed expert on here.
Right.
I'm fascinated by that. Okay.
So
Brooklyn Regional Office.
So Brooklyn Regional Office. So we did a lot of predatory lending. We did consumer fraud. I was part of a team that worked with the Civil Rights Bureau on the stop and frisk abuses of NYPD. Then went on to become a city council member, where I drafted laws and continued to do litigation. I mentioned the Atlantic Yards Project, where we sued the developer. Worked in the state legislature, where I drafted, negotiated bills. And then, as a public advocate of the city of New York, have written more bills than all previous public advocates, and that includes Mary de Blasio, who was the previous public advocate, Betsy Gottbahn, and Mark Green, transformed the office, where we've introduced litigation and sued the mayor, sued the governor, sued quite a few landlords, and on behalf of vulnerable individuals, and just on behalf of New Yorkers in general. And we've introduced legislation, we've done litigation, we've done advocacy, we've resolved over 32,000 constituent complaints. So we are best suited to become the next attorney general because we've done it already. And now we'll do it on a larger scale all throughout the state of New York.
Now, as we come to an end, I did have another question for you as public advocate. Yep. Is the turnstile jumping as a crime?
Yeah. It needs to be civil in nature, not criminal.
Can you do anything about that as attorney general?
The city council came up with a proposal that it would not be prosecuted in criminal court, but in civil court. It would be treated as a civil offense and not a criminal offense.
Did that pass, or is that still a proposal?
I'm not sure if it passed. I do know that if you jump over a turnstile and you don't have ID, you'll go through the criminal system. If you have ID, it's my understanding that you'll get a summons. And then you'll have to go to the civil part as opposed to the criminal part. Okay. It's an effort to reduce the over-criminalization of people of color.
It's like 80% of the people who get arrested,
which is why we need to reduce a lot of these criminal offenses and to make them civil. For instance, riding your bike on a sidewalk is a criminal offense. Changing that. Sitting in
over
a park.
Over what age? Like in...
Anybody.
Oh, anybody?
Anybody. Anybody, anybody. I had to stop police from stopping kids from riding their bike in public housing because they were riding on a sidewalk. And I argued it was just an excuse to stop and frisk them.
Anybody? So in
anybody.
We just covered this in the news. It's like in Chicago, it's like over the age of like, 11 or something.
No, it's...
Will the city council just not repeal this? Like, what's going on?
So it's an issue. It's now civil. It was part of the package, including jumping over the turnstile. And then issues like such as sitting in the park after dusk, that's a criminal offense. And I never knew when dusk was. And it was always individuals of color who were prosecuted for this. Marijuana arrests, which is why I support the decriminalization of marijuana. What else? Oh, these catch-all crimes.
Why isn't the dust thing just not an offense? Like, why does it still have to be something? Because you and I know that the enforcement, civil or criminal, the disparities still show up.
I think part of it had to do with people were overprotective of children and playgrounds. And I think at the time, I think there was this sensitivity to children who were being abducted. And so individuals who were sitting in playgrounds by themselves, near playgrounds where children were playing, I guess they wanted a basis for the police to ask you what you were doing at a playground by yourself.
I might give you that, but the bike thing?
And I don't buy that because maybe you're just resting. Maybe you're reading a book. Maybe, you know.
And I'm only saying because you saw the marijuana data that I just saw that 90% of the people are black and brown. And that is...
That's right. Which is why
we know that's
we're moving towards, I think, by the end of the year, hopefully by the end of the year, decriminalizing marijuana. But we got to make sure that people of color have a stake in it. We need more minority businesses involved in having dispensaries. We need to address the issue of criminal records and expunging criminal records or sealing criminal records. We need to make sure that they're not all located in communities of color. So all these issues and more we've got to deal with. We've got to deal with these arbitrary limits on how many people can enter into this business. Like it shouldn't require you to have like $5 million in order to have a dispensary. We need some sort of... ability for you to get insurance, for you to get bonding, all these issues and more.
Now, one of the questions that we ask everybody is, what is a piece of advice that you've gotten over the years that stuck with you?
Ooh, piece of advice. Never stop fighting. Always stand up. And always realize the power that you have that's in your hands. And remember where you come from and whose legacy you stand on.
And where can people go to learn more about you and the campaign?
They can Google me. It's L-E-T-I-T-I-A, James. People often refer to me as Tish, T-I-S-H, James.
Have you been Tish your whole life?
I'm Tish my whole life. My whole life, Tish.
Is that what your parents called you?
Yeah. Well, they called me other things, but anyway. But it's Letitia, Tish James, and I'm running for Attorney General. And the election is on a Thursday, and that's important. Because normally it's on a Tuesday, and they changed the date to a Thursday. And so we don't want to have happen what happened to a Congress member in Queens who lost his election because people didn't get out to vote. We need individuals to know that this is a Thursday, and they need to come out and vote. And they need to come out and vote.
And when is it?
The 13th of September.
Why is it not November? Why is
it not that's the general election. That's the midterm election.
Oh, the primary.
It's a Democratic primary.
Got it.
And so I need individuals to come out and vote. Because in New York City, it's all about primaries. But this is New York State, so I'm running statewide. So even all of your listeners upstate need to come out and vote on September 13th. And once again, make history. And once again, elect Letitia James, who I believe is the best candidate for Attorney General, who understands justice, and who is a true fighter, and who has a record of getting things done. This is not an academic exercise for me. This is about protecting marginalized and vulnerable people who are under attack right now and standing up for our values and our principles as New Yorkers and as Americans, because everything is at stake right now. You can find me at tishjames2018.com. You can tweet me at tishjames. You can Facebook me at tishjames for AG, or you could Instagram me, which doesn't last long, tishjames2018, and it's T-I-S-H-J-A-M-E-S 2018. One word.
Boom.
Save on quality sofas, sectionals, top brand mattresses, and more during Haverty's President's Day sale. Find the style of furniture you've been looking for at Haverty's, online, or in Columbus at Polaris.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.